It's 2:06, and you're listening to the Monday edition of Political Rewind on GPB. I'm Bradley George, filling in for Bill Nigut, who's on vacation somewhere. He could be hiking Machu Picchu. He could be partying in Ibiza. We're not quite sure where he is, but we hope he's having a relaxing time. He will be back with you next week. In the meantime, I'll be keeping down the fort today, Wednesday, and Friday. And joining me today is Jim Galloway from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jim, good to see you as always.
Good afternoon, Bradley.
Also here with us in the studio, Republican political consultant and strategist Heath Garrett. Heath, welcome to you.
Bradley, it's a great Monday and great to be here with you.
Democratic strategist Theron Johnson will be with us. He's running a little late. He'll be here with us in a few minutes as well. And on the line from Washington is Tamar Halliman, who is a Washington reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tamar, we're glad you're with us as well.
You know, I can really picture Nigut partying it up in Ibiza. I'm glad you mentioned that.
I don't want to think about that too much, but maybe he is. Who knows?
None of us
who
do.
Yeah. And if you're listening to us on the radio, that's great. You can also watch us on Facebook. We're on the GPB News Facebook page. And you can leave comments and questions for us there as well. You can also tweet your thoughts to us. We're on Twitter at PoliticsGPB. A lot to talk about today, as there is always. We're going to start today with the governor's race, and we're going to talk about endorsements. Jim, we have a sitting governor who's getting ready to leave office, Nathan Deal. His lieutenant governor is one of the folks in this runoff.
Right.
And he has not endorsed either candidate. And Governor Deal's chief of staff has also warned both the candidates, well, really all the candidates running in the governor's race, not to criticize Deal and his record in any way.
Yeah, this kind of comes off of a post that Greg Bluestein, our AJC colleague, Greg Bluestein did over the weekend when he followed Cagle to Toccoa for a campaign stop. And, you know, if you remember back in the Reagan candidacy in 1980, maybe you don't. Maybe you weren't. I was just a baby.
All right.
Okay. Well, there was Ronald Reagan was trying to woo Southern Baptists and Southern evangelicals away from Jimmy Carter, who'd put Carter in the White House, and Reagan came up with this great line. He said, "I know you can't endorse me, but I endorse you." And that's exactly what Casey Cagle is doing right now. With he is very firm, very much trying to tie himself to the good feelings that Nathan Deal has generated over 8 years. Nathan Deal is the most popular politician in Georgia right now, even more popular than Trump. So it is a smart thing to do, and it's a smart thing to do because Casey Cagle has had some problems with that secret recording. I'm sure that has caused him some problems, but this is one of his solutions, one of his comebacks.
Heath, what's your thoughts on this?
No, that's a great line from Ronald Reagan and a good memory of it. Exactly right. There are three or four politicians that if you're running for statewide office, you want to endorse, even if they're not endorsing you. There's no question that the governor is at the top of that list. Governor Deal has a incredibly popular record, both in the primary and in the general election. He's been a really strong and convicted governor. It's attracting a lot of independent voters. But Casey Cagle's from his neck of the woods.
Right, Georgia. Hall County, although they've never really been close.
That was about to be the point that I was going to make, is that, yeah, they've been in office concurrently, but there's not much of a connection.
Yeah, they live close to each other, yeah. but you might not call them neighbors.
You know, Chris Riley, the governor's chief of staff, and Casey have been close over the years, and there have been times where people have confused them as brothers or cousins or that close. And I know that when you become the governor and you've got a lieutenant governor, there are little things that happen there, but there's a lot of similarity there. And I think there's a big question as to who would most likely create the third term of Nathan Deal, right? When you have a popular president or governor, there's a lot of that goes into the factoring here. In the Republican primary, Governor Deal is very, very popular. And I think that Casey Cagle warming up to him and arguing that he was the closest thing to being a third term of Governor Deal is a smart strategy, even in a low turnout primary.
Okay, so that's the relationship between Nathan Deal and Casey Cagle. But Jim, what about Nathan Deal and Brian Kemp?
A different story. And quite frankly, I've never been able to get to the bottom of it. But for several years, as Secretary of State, Brian Kemp has had to endure these constant cuts to his budget. I mean, and that very pretty much, and a lot of those have been instigated by the governor's office as kind of poaching on his territory. We want this. We want to be able to regulate this profession rather than you. We want you to handle it this way rather than that.
And even moving some functions. I think what was it? I might be totally wrong about this. It was the Office of Consumer Affairs or Consumer Protection that was moved from
it was something
the
like
Secretary
that,
yeah. of State to the Attorney General's office. Right.
It was something like that. Yeah. And it was it's a little bit less. Plus, you've got some fairly distinctive policy differences between Kemp and Cagle that haven't been spoken about too much. I mean, Kemp has said he would not ask for one more federal dime in Medicaid funding for Georgia. Casey Cagle has very carefully said that if it can be done in the right fiscal circumstances, he would like to cut a separate deal with the federal government over Medicaid waivers. And then there's also the fact that Brian Kemp has he's really concentrated on rural Georgia, on South Georgia in particular, and he has said that we need to devolve some of the stuff that's happening into Atlanta and send some of those institutions, whether they're bureaucratic or whether they're industrial, we need to send some of that stuff down to South Georgia for economic development purposes.
Yeah, one thing worth noting in all of this also is we talk about Casey Cagle kind of tying himself to the legacy of Nathan Deal, but on perhaps Nathan Deal's one of the most consequential decisions of his tenure, vetoing this religious liberty bill in 2016. That's an issue that both Kemp and Cagle disagree with him on. Both of them have pledged to sign a religious liberty bill should the legislature present him with one. So that's a major thing where they do dither from the sitting governor.
No, I think that's a good point. And when you get to Brian Kemp, I don't knowing all the players, I don't think there's any distance between the governor and Brian personally. I do think that Brian has the difficulty, as we've seen over the history of politics, of being the Secretary of State. It's just not viewed as that powerful position. Governors oftentimes use it to either put political favors into that office or take them away because they want to put them somewhere else. It is interesting to me that Brian Kemp's campaign does not seem to have done the same thing Casey Cagle's done, which is to go out and say, well, you're not endorsing me. I'm going to endorse mm-hmm. you, which may have been a missed opportunity. It looks like he's pivoted and starting to say, I'm going to endorse Trump, which is, I know, a subject we're going to get to later on. But it's interesting to me that the Kemp campaign has not gone out of its way to say we're going to be that. Now, they do on Twitter and other places endorse economic progress and some of the mm-hmm. things that the governor's doing. So they're not running away from the governor by any sense, but definitely not as full of an embrace. And the bigger question is, are either of them going to do it in paid media? Like, we'd like to talk about this as if it's happening and the whole world's seeing it. Until somebody pays money and puts it on radio or television or use digital advertising, does it really matter?
That's interesting, because you would think if Cagle's strategy is to tie himself to Nathan Deal, that there would be some kind of, and maybe there will be in this last sort of push before the runoff to make that more apparent to voters.
And what you're doing is on the ground, at the grassroots level, you're putting out a message, seeing how it flies. If it soars, then you put it on TV. If it doesn't, then you move on. I think this is something that he's likely to do. And I will tell you what, if Casey Cagle, if we get closer to the 24th and Casey Cagle looks to be in trouble, I'm thinking we might see Nathan Deal step out.
I was going to say, we should not rule out the possibility of a Nathan Deal endorsement in the last couple of weeks. So it's been a smart strategy to tell all the candidates at the beginning of the primary, if you attack us, we're going to defend our record and our legacy. That kind of set the table a few months back, holding that out. But also holding out his endorsement has probably tamed the primary runoff a little bit. It doesn't seem tame to the average voter, but it's tamer than it could be out there. So I think that's right. I think you still could see Nathan Deal come off the sidelines.
Well, Heath, you mentioned Donald Trump, and as a matter of fact, President Trump is in South Carolina tonight, where he's holding a rally for Governor Henry McMaster, who is in a runoff of his own against a GOP challenger, John Warren. McMaster, he became governor after Nikki Haley was appointed UN ambassador. He's been somebody who's been a supporter of Trump for a long time. He's been a Trump ally. I wonder, Jim, would we at some point see similar maneuvering here in the governor's race?
Well, if we could bring Tamar in on this.
Yeah.
Tamar, I mean, one of the things that I've always thought of is that in the Georgia governor's race, whether you're Brian Kemp or you're Casey Cagle, if you want Trump's attention, you pretty much need to go through the Perdue cousins in D.C. Am I reading that right?
I mean, that's definitely a very direct way to go to the president. It seems like, at least in the cabinet, Sonny Perdue's one of the few that's really stayed on the president's good side. You see also with Senator Perdue, they're often at the White House talking about everything from immigration to trade deals with China. So that certainly is a way to do it. And I will say that so far in the governor's race, in the last week or two, you really have started seeing maneuvering from Cagle and Kemp, even though both of them, initially backed other candidates, now trying to prove I'm the Trumpiest of the candidates. I support him more. If anybody has shown even, a smidge of doubt, it's the other guy, and that's why you can't vote for him.
I will say an interesting turn in Republican politics over the last couple of years has been that a large percentage of the Republican base, when asked the question of which policies do they care the most about, if you actually, instead of saying the economy or a social issue or immigration or something like that, if you say stand with Trump as if it is its own policy initiative, that oftentimes wins the day.
Really?
To show
really?
You,
this is new. This is a real polling question out there now?
Do you stand with Trump as a generic question, and it exceeds lower taxes at times in the Republican primary, particularly in low voter turnout situations, which is what this runoff will be. And so I really think that more important than the question about Governor Deal is which one of these candidates can show that they stand with Trump in a way that resonates with the voters, but also then preserves their right to win in the general election, because it's a fine line. Johnny Isaacson's walked it, a couple of others, but it is a fine line to walk to stand with Trump, yet preserve your ability to win in the general election.
So this kind of explains why the Cagle campaign went after Brian Kemp for, in August of 2016, saying the Republican nominee is the Republican nominee we've got.
Absolutely. If you can show a shred of lack of loyalty in that regard in a low turnout primary like this, it's important.
So Theron,
in the meantime, you've seen Cagle dig up an old tweet of Galloway's from like 2015 when John Kasich was in town, too. It's pretty amazing. Some poor intern had to go through years and years of our tweets, but pretty amazing stuff.
All right. So Theron Johnson's with us now, and I want to get his take on this. And Heath alluded to this. You know, it's one thing, Theron, to court Donald Trump during a Republican runoff where you're trying to turn out the Republican base. But it's a very different thing to talk about support from the president when you're in a general election scenario where you're facing Stacey Abrams.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what Heath just said is exactly spot on. I mean, when I talked to a lot of Republicans outside of the metro area, I was down in Southeast Georgia and Southwest Georgia in the last couple weeks, and I asked them that fundamental question. I said, what is it about President Trump that makes you have this sort of unwavering support to him? And believe it or not, a lot of them disagree with him as sort of his tone and his sort of approach to how he governs this country. But they say, look, he's been there for a while. The economy is headed in the right direction, and we support him. So fast forward to how Casey Cagle and Brian Kemp deals with that. I think that what you're seeing is that they understand that the people who are going to early vote in this election, or many of whom have already either sent in the absentee ballots or have the absentee applications, are some of the radical right-wing Republicans who support Donald Trump. And so I think what they're trying to do is get as many of these Trump supporters as you can on board early, and then try to get some of the more sensible compassionate conservatives, many like Heath and others who I know, that truly are going to look at what's best for the party to get their votes. And then ultimately, I think that combination will help either one of those gentlemen prevail.
Heath.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And like I said, it's a fine line, right? You've got to, and it is interesting. I was in these great communities where I come from. I was down in Albany and Moultrie and Thomasville on Thursday and Friday of last week, meeting with a lot of Republican primary voters. And it was interesting. They stand with Trump. They'll say, I wish he wouldn't tweet as much. I don't like the tone. I don't like two or three issues, but it's still kind of trumps, if you will, all other things that they do want their elected officials in the Republican Party to say they're standing with him because he is symbolic of fighting federal bureaucracy, fighting the mainstream media, and standing up for the rural and kind of ex-urban forgotten American, if you will. So I think it's a fascinating line, but you do have to be able to win this runoff and then turn right back around. Trump is almost as unpopular among independent voters around the nation as he is popular with Republican primary voters. The question is about Georgia independent voters in November. They're a little bit more center right than the nation, and I think it's going to be a great battle to see because Stacey Abrams is going to own her base, and our nominee is going to own the Trump base, and we're going to find out where the middle comes out. I think it's a fine line for Casey Cagle and Brian DeWalt, though, in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Hey, Tamar, has the Trump administration, has the White House given any sort of clue that while the president is in South Carolina, whether he'll look over this way? I mean, in his tweets, I can't tell that he's paid the Georgia governor's race any attention at all.
Yeah, I haven't heard much about it either. I know that he's very much eager to get on the road to campaign for different candidates. And I think it kind of depends on where it is, right? There's some places where that's very much a liability to have him out there in kind of those suburban swing districts. But at the same time, in those deeply conservative places, maybe more rural areas, the great benefit. But so far, we really haven't heard him tweet about this race at all or weigh in on it in any way. And even when he does meet with, you know, governors who come up and visit the White House and stuff, you never see Nathan Deal in that crowd.
No, actually, David Ralston, the House Speaker, is probably the highest ranking Georgia official who's been in the White House lately.
But you know what's,
yeah, exactly.
But you know what's so interesting about this? And Galloway, you've written about this. You know, our last two Republican governors have been Democrats, and they've switched to being a Republican. And so let's just look at this from a mathematical standpoint, right? And Heath, you know this from running campaigns. It's exactly what he said. You turn out your base, so it's kind of a 40-40. And then you want to have a candidate, he or she, that can kind of go off and pick up enough independents. And what we've seen from Nathan Deal and Sonny Perdue is that even though they were Republicans, they could go get a few white Democrats in Cobb or in Southeast and in Southwest Georgia and North Georgia. What's very interesting now with Casey Cagle and Kemp, knowing that they're about to just tear each other's heads off, literally and figuratively, in this runoff, is that they're not going to be able to kind of move back to the center, I think, the way that we've seen in the past. And what they've got to be very careful is that while Donald Trump's name is not being mentioned, a lot of the sort of policies that they're talking about, a lot of the things that they're associating themselves with, it then opens up a lane for Abrams to start saying, okay, well, what about this? What do you support about this president? You made this vote when you were in the Senate, or when you was lieutenant governor, mm-hmm. you did this Secretary of State. So I think that Georgia Republicans are sort of conflicted because they've been used to, for the last 16 years, a Johnny Isaacson, Nathan Deal, Sonny Perdue light Republican. The question is, if Casey Cagle or Brian Kemp emerges, what type of Republican will they be? And I just think in this Trump world right now we're seeing in the South, it's going to be very hard to be that type of Republican that we've seen in the past while Trump supporters are expecting you to be radically right.
I agree with you, Theron, but I also think that the voters have changed. Overall, we've just become so much more of a partisan society. There's far fewer people in the middle to kind of win over.
Tamar, I think that's a great point. I was going to say the only thing I would slightly disagree with Theron on is the bases aren't 40-40 in Georgia quite yet. It's more like 45-40. Tamar, I think you and Theron are both right. There's a shrinking center independent voter, right, because the polarization of Georgia voters and nationally is actually growing both parties and shrinking the center at a time where prior to Trump, the center was growing. It was actually going in the opposite direction. And so I think as that center shrinks here in November. I think both Kemp and Cagle both can grow back to the middle for different reasons, one's personality and one's policy, but it's going to be a real challenge from them after a 9-week brutal runoff.
Bradley,
you saw it a little bit during there was a GPB debate right before the Republican primary, where you saw people like Casey Cagle talk a lot about a lot of what Governor Deal has done to lure the film industry to Georgia, to talk about the AAA bond rating, a lot of economic stuff. I think that will be, you'll see that a lot from whoever comes out of this runoff as they kind of angle for those independents in November.
As long as we're talking about this, Bradley, is it time for us to shift to the Red Hen?
What is the Red Hen?
The Red Hen restaurant.
Oh, yeah. I was going to save that for the end.
Okay, all right.
I want to, actually, we're...
I've jumped the gun.
Gosh, we're almost to 2:30. We haven't taken a break yet. So let's get the break out of the way. And then when we come back, we're going to talk with Tamar a little bit for this article that she has in the AJC about the impact of Trump's tariffs on Georgia businesses. So we will be talking about that in just a couple of minutes here on Political Rewind on GPB.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks. I'm gonna get in my car.
Drive so far. Thanks for joining us for Political Rewind on GPB. I'm Bradley George here today with Jim Galloway from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Republican strategist Heath Garrett, Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, and AJC reporter Tamar Halliman. Tamar, I want to start this next part of the show talking about this piece that you co-wrote in the AJC about the impact of some of the tariffs that President Trump has announced on Georgia businesses. What did you find out in your reporting that surprised you?
Well, what was interesting, we were talking in the first segment about how, as a Republican official in Georgia, it really pays to line up with the president wholeheartedly in pretty much everything you do. The tariff issue, though, is one where you do see even the president's most prominent allies in Georgia very carefully distance themselves from the administration. So you even saw people like David Perdue, perhaps his most prominent ally in the Senate, Karen Handel, who had never broken with him publicly on policy stuff, kind of say, hey, this is not a good idea. We're really worried that these tariffs are way too broad. And as we reported this story, my colleague Mike Cannell and I, we just found that tariffs would impact so many different industries in Georgia, everything from the auto industry to Home Depot to Georgia Pacific to ag industry. The biggest exports from Georgia are all ag-related. So pretty much across the board, kind of negative effects for a lot of Georgia industries.
Well, one of the interesting things in your piece that stuck out to me, you spoke to a business owner in Kennesaw, and he's someone who's affected by these tariffs, but he still says that he supports Trump 100%.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the argument that a lot of people in Trump's cabinet, including Sonny Perdue, have been saying, have faith in the way that the president negotiates. Yes, there may be kind of a short-term pinch on your finances, but just know that this is for the better good at the end of the day. Kind of, trust us. And at least this business owner in Kennesaw we talked to did trust the president.
Well, and I can add to that tomorrow. I was down in Albany and Moultrie and Thomasville, and primarily agribusiness men and women at all these events. And it was fascinating. They were talking on the one hand about how these trade wars could actually impact their business negatively, particularly as the growing exports to China from Southwest Georgia. I mean, remember, agribusiness is still the number one industry in the state of Georgia. A lot of our urban and suburban voters forget that. At the same time, on the other hand, they said, but we're okay with it because we think it's a negotiating tactic and we're still with Trump. So it creates this interesting issue for elected officials here.
Okay, question for the group here. Where's the breaking point, if there is one?
Yeah.
Is there a breaking point and where is it?
I don't know. And I think the thing is that if you just look at this from a historical standpoint, right? I mean, this is nothing but Donald Trump really flexing his muscles, but it's also basically about to enter our country into a trade war. And we know that historically, whenever you enter into a trade war, they never end well. And so I think that at a time when this was first rolled out, it was right after the president went and met with the prime minister of North Korea. So it's like, okay, he doubles down on his foreign affairs ability to have this meeting. And then, oh, by the way, we're talking about tariffs. But then we saw Johnny Isaacson come out on the floor of the Senate publicly and said, you know what, I'm not agreeing with this tactic. I'm not agreeing with the direction of our country, because what the president wants us to believe is that he wants to show his muscle and his unilateral positioning on tariffs, but then he is either sometimes for free trade, open trade, but then he's against it. And so I think that this is nothing but another political stunt by this president to try to, you know, sow smoke on this side while he's trying to do some very, you know, slick things on this side. And so I just think that we're really about to enter into a trade war.
Yeah, it's to me the use of national security as the raison d'etre for all of these tariffs. I don't think he's levied a tariff without citing national security, right?
I think that's correct.
And the willingness of Congress to accept that, to me, is very worrisome. I know Bob Corker, senator from Tennessee. I think he was on Meet the Press this weekend saying that he smells a jailbreak coming, but I haven't seen it.
Well, and you ask, where's the line? And I do think that that's a growing number of Republicans have signed on to Corker's legislation, including Senator Isaacson, I believe.
And
what
does this legislation do?
This legislation, yeah. Go ahead, Tamar. I'll let you explain it.
This bill, it's a bipartisan bill that would require Congress to sign off on any tariffs that are levied in the name of national security. So kind of like a congressional check on what the president is doing. And what's so interesting is that, you know, for so long, for the last, even before Obama, the last 30 years, Congress has been kind of slowly abdicating a lot of its authority, giving it to the president. You've seen it with war powers. You've seen it with plenty of things over the years. And you saw it a lot during Obama, where Republican officials say, you know, we can't give the executive branch all this power. But now they're being tested because Trump is so popular. You don't want to be seen as getting in his way. But there is a really interesting debate going on about how far is too far.
Well, and oftentimes you ask Jim on this show, you know, when are folks going to stand up? And I think a number of Republican senators, obviously with their background in free trade and the benefits that it are not only to Georgia but to the nation, are starting to do that here. I do think this is a classic Trump situation too, where he's actually in the right on the global policy from most conservatives' perspective. China is a problem. It's a national, their trade and what they're doing with their currency and what they're doing with stealing our intellectual property is a national security threat. And it's an economic security threat. The real debate within the Republican Party and conservatives is, what about the tactics? Is this the right tactic? Is this the right way to go? But that's why I think you're seeing some of our voters go, well, we're with them because we definitely know China's a problem. And some of the intellectuals are saying it absolutely is a problem. Is this the right way to go about doing it? And we're obviously hitting Canada and Mexico with some of this. Well, the reason why is because China and Europe are using our own NAFTA against us, so to speak, by locating their facilities in these countries. So anyway, I think it's a fascinating dichotomy for Trump.
So here's what's interesting to me about this. For the last 30, 40 years, southern states have worked hard to promote themselves internationally. You have Georgia has trade missions all over the world. South Carolina, Alabama, North Carolina, Tennessee do as well. Maybe Jen or Tamar can jump in on this. What does a trade war do to those efforts? How does that affect this state's ability to go out and kind of promote itself on a global stage?
I mean, it surely makes it a lot harder. You know, you're still seeing officials from the state saying, you know, Georgia's open for business. We still want to, you know, keep all this up. We've worked so hard. You're seeing on a national level, Sonny Perdue just went up to Canada last week to meet with his, you know, his Canadian counterpart to show, you know, we still believe in trade and we still are lovey-dovey. But, you know, words are one thing and actions are another. And you're seeing, especially with a lot of these specific tariffs from places like Canada, places like China, you know, they're going after maximum pain. They're trying to get people like Paul Ryan. You saw, I believe it was China going after Harley Davidson products. You saw somebody else go after bourbon from Kentucky to go after Mitch McConnell. These are very specifically targeted tariffs at specific people. So at some point, I do wonder where that breaking point is. And Theron, I have no idea where that is.
Bradley, to your point is you're right. Since George Busby, Georgia's economic development strategy has been to get foreign investment into the state because we have needed the capital. And part of the agreement that comes with accepting foreign capital is the kind of the quiet agreement that, yes, we'll trade with you and you can ship us stuff and we will buy it as part of your investment in our society. And so when you start levying tariffs willy-nilly, you're going after the system, the economic system that the South has built over the last 40, 50 years. And that's why you've got the interesting thing is you've got Donald Trump trying to save the Rust Belt, which is mostly the northern based economy and the economy of the 50s. And it's coming. It will come at a cost of the economy that the South has built, say, since the 1970s.
Well, I think the other thing here is Nahitha is going to be shocked to hear me say this, but I'm actually going to have to compliment the president and how he frames this, because if there's one thing that Donald Trump has shown us that he can do amazingly well, is that he has his base and, quite frankly, millions of others who voted for him for whatever reason, that he wants to put America first. And so how he framed this whole tariff and sort of trade debate was that we're paying our fair share, but we're not getting anything in return. I mean, if you really closely listen to what Heath just talked about with Mexico and Canada, I mean, it's very masterful how Republicans are saying, hey, it's very un-American to not put America first. But where Trump is going to really, I think, hurt a lot of his people in the midterm, people who are running in some very not so conservative district, is that it's actually going to hit the manufacturing industry, which is an industry that he's been targeting and trying to be one of his more staunch supporters. And so the framing of it is sort of it's American. It's American to make sure that we are paying our fair share, but more importantly, that we're not paying more than some of our counterparts are. But I think ultimately manufacturing is into Georgia to point that people, when they saw this on the news and they thought it was, you know, sort of pro-Trump and good to put America first, they were like, oh my God, this may actually affect us negatively. So I think as this debate continues, and I agree with you, Tamar, I don't know where we draw the line, but I think that you're going to see more and more Republicans start saying, ooh, this is not something that I really want to be a part of. And then more importantly, I want to applaud Senator Corker. I mean, for him as a person who's had some battles with this president, who's paid the price for doing the right thing and being outspoken, to introduce this bipartisan bill and for Republicans to come on board and to sign it. I mean, that's very courageous of them.
Well, he's also not running for re-election.
Right. Yeah. but more importantly, I mean, you kind of want to stay away from guys or girls like that because you know they don't have anything to lose. But it has gotten a groundswell of support, which means I think that this Congress is finally deciding to try to put some restrictions on this president.
And on this issue, right, James Carville said it's the economy.
Stupid.
At the end of the day, right now what we're talking about, if you take all the trade tariffs, it's still only a fraction of 1% of global trade with the United States of America that we're talking about. So there's all this sound and fury and thunder, and we're talking about trade war rhetoric, but the part of the global trade that he's actually attacking in real tariffs is a fraction of a percent. So if it doesn't hurt people in their pocketbooks, if it really doesn't start to hurt industries, if it turns out that most people are going to still be doing trade or 99.5% of that trade's going forward, then I think we'd get a different story.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to bring Tamar back in because, Tamar, just to kind of push back a little bit on Heath's point, I mean, some of the people you talked to in your piece said that they're already seeing some real impacts from what the president's announced.
Yeah, for sure. And what's so fascinating to me about this whole topic of trade is that it really has jumbled the political calculus. You're seeing liberal groups that normally have never had anything nice to say about the president saying, oh, well, actually, it's not so bad yet. Like, it's really going to be okay, and maybe this will help in the long term. But then you have Republican groups, or you have groups like the Georgia Chamber that typically don't want to criticize a Republican president, coming out and saying, actually, this is really, you know, this is really bad. People are already getting pinched. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see.
But other thing is this, and I want to be careful for all the Democrats who are listening. There is a small group of Democrats, particularly people who support Bernie Sanders, that actually quietly are applauding this president for tariffs. Because you got to remember, this is a group that was all against free trade. I mean, they were. That was one of the things that really prompt, really kind of kicked off the Bernie.
Do you have an example of that?
No, because, I mean, so the example is that if you look at really what Bernie Sanders has talked about as being an independent who caucuses with the Democrats, he ran a very anti, you know, free trade sort of message.
And right, then, I remember that. But yeah. can you give me an example of a Democrat, if even if it's an activist, if it's a politician, no, or somebody who says they support what the president's doing?
No, so what I'm telling you is that when you start talking about tariffs and you start saying that the country has entered into NAFTA, and we've entered into these trade deals that has some people feel it had a positive impact, but some a negative impact. There's a small group of Bernie supporters that I've talked to in Washington and even here in Georgia that will secretly not say this publicly, but would applaud the president for at least looking into these tariffs that they believe that haven't always in a very, you know, beneficial way impacted our country.
And Bradley, I would just jump in here. I would say that if you Theron, I'm losing his name. The past president of the AFL-CIO,
Richard Trump.
Richard Ray.
Richard Ray. Yes. I talked to Richard Ray about this very topic maybe 8 months ago, and he's retired, so he can speak freely. But he said some of this tariff stuff and is really resonating with union members.
Yeah, the AFL-CIO came out I know in March and April in full support of the steel tariffs, right? So I think there's a Fascinating. Now, I want to correct. I mean, it's not Bernie Sanders as an independent who caucuses with Democrats. It's Bernie Sanders as a socialist who caucuses with the Democrats.
Can I get that in? but see, and so what I was saying, Bradley, is that while, you know, you think that this president is sort of just doing things to just, you know, be very anti-Democrats. But what he's also doing is that he realizes that he's trying to put together this coalition of his angry, you know, right-wing constituents and some people in our party, in the Democratic Party, who are still upset that Tom Perez is the DNC chair, that is still looking for Bernie Sanders to run, that are still pushing Democrats to have a message and tell people what we're for. So to Jim's point, it's very interesting to hear that Richard Ray, who was a person who doesn't get the credit he deserves for being an outspoken leader, who at that time in the 90s, and even in the late 80s, was the go-to guy for Democrats being elected in this state. But for him to say that he's hearing that from union members, therein lies my point about how Democrats have got to have a very concise message of why these tariffs are bad for America.
Look at where Bernie did well. He did well in a lot of those Rust Belt states, yep, like Michigan, like Wisconsin, like Ohio. And those are the places where you're hearing some, you know, some support from Democrats over this. So it's interesting to see. At the same time, I will say, you know, there's talk about this bill from Senator Corker that Isaacson supports about giving congressional approval to these tariffs. It's not going to happen here on the Hill.
That was going to be my question for you, Demaria.
Yeah, Mitch McConnell has already said, I believe the quote was, it's an exercise in futility. He not only does he have a kind of a limited calendar to deal with, he also doesn't want to make his Republican members, he doesn't want to anger the Republican base, put them in kind of a precarious spot. So we're not going to get a vote on this anytime soon.
Okay, here's a line. Now, I will throw out a suggestion for a line. Minds will begin to change, and publicly, the tariff issue will be seized when a cargo ship full of frozen chicken feet from Georgia is melting in Hong Kong Bay.
Okay.
When you start to see huge physical losses in the ag community, I think that's when you may see something change.
All right then. And with that, we will move on from trade, and now we're going to go to immigration, and we're going to start with something that broke during Friday's show, and that was this exchange between Karen Handel and Ted Lieu, who's a Democratic congressman from California. Handel was presiding over the House as a Speaker pro tem. Lieu was on the House floor, and he was trying to play some audio of children crying in one of these detention centers in Texas. And it was this awkward back and forth that went on for about 6 minutes, Jim, between Handel and Ted Lieu. What What, if any, kind of impact is this going to have on the runoff in the Democratic runoff in the 6th district?
Well, number one, this was something thrust upon Karen Handel. She did not choose it.
Right.
Friday afternoon duty is a chore that's assigned to low ranking members, and to me, it's another example of Democrats kind of pushing the envelope on what they're willing to do in a chamber that they don't have, in which they don't have any power. What was interesting to me about the video, you will see the video. The video will make its presence probably in, you know, either in Lucy McBath's campaign or Kevin Abel's campaign. Those are the two Democrats who are left. But if you watch it, what's interesting is that both Karen Handel and Ted Lieu are facing in the same direction. You know, they weren't this wasn't a confrontation. Karen Handel was speaking to the California congressman's back, and the California congressman was speaking to the audience. And there is a very strict House chamber rule about the use of electronic sound, and the congressman clearly broke that.
And by audience, let me just say, it is C-SPAN. all the theatrics you've seen, it is all because of C-SPAN. You never used to see these crazy, you know, addresses with all these crazy stunts. It's all made for the cameras because they know that people are watching at home and they know these can make great campaign videos. Ted Lieu knew that he was breaking a rule. And like Galloway said, when you're the minority in the House, you don't have the filibuster like you do in the Senate. You really are kind of powerless to the whims of the majority. And they knew that they, you know, they're not going to get a vote on what they want as Democrats. So this was a way for them to at least get some headlines out of it, which is what they got. And you did see immediately after, you know, within an hour, the campaigns of Abel and McBath, the two Democrats, immediately pouncing on it, saying, you know, if Karen Handel can't stand up to her party on immigration, blah, blah, blah. You know, what they didn't say is she was one of the only Republicans who actually responded to us when we asked about what was happening on the border. But I'm sure that is something we will see over and over again in the next few weeks on the campaign.
I think that's exactly right. I think it's a PR victory for Congressman Lieu, but I don't think this really hurts Karen Handel necessarily in the general election. I do think that it is good fodder for the Democratic runoff in that district. If she were to have handled it dramatically differently or had a different position longer term on this, then it could be an issue in the general election. But the 6th district, as we all know, is the most affluent and educated district probably in the Southeast, if not one of them in the country. And I think that Karen's handling this issue about exactly right for that district.
Tamar, there are a couple of pieces of immigration legislation that the House has been considering. Are we going to see any movement on those this week?
Yeah, there was a vote last week on a more conservative proposal that was being, that President Trump had endorsed. That one fell about, I believe it was 40 votes shy of passage, but it was still a lot better than people thought it would do. That one, it was mainly about giving legal status to Dreamers. It would not give them a pathway to citizenship, though. It would have built a wall on the southern border, beefed up border security, require E-Verify for employers. That one did not pass. There's going to be a vote at some point this week on what is called the Compromise Immigration Plan, which was drafted by Republican leaders to win over Republican moderates who really want citizenship for Dreamers. That one's not expected to pass either. And it'll be very interesting to see, though, how many Georgia Republicans will back this more moderate version. All but one Georgia Republican backed the more conservative plan last week, which I, to be honest, was a little surprised by. So we'll see if how many people will, how many fewer people will back this compromise plan this week.
Jim, do you have any intelligence on how Georgia Republicans will vote on this this other bill?
No, but I thought it was interesting that the defector tomorrow was Drew Ferguson out of
West Point
and West Georgia, and I thought that was kind of interesting. Even Karen Handel and Rob Woodall, who are pretty much considered the most vulnerable members of Congress from Georgia, didn't. They backed the more conservative plan.
And have we heard anything from Ferguson about why he voted against this bill?
You know, I talked to his people last week, and they gave me kind of a cryptic statement about how they didn't think it, how he didn't think it properly addressed issues like border security and the Dreamers. But there was no, you know, when I tried to follow up to ask for more details, I got totally stonewalled. And that's something I'll definitely be asking him this week once the House reconvenes.
All right. And we are at 10 minutes till 3 o'clock. We need to get another break in. We're going to do that now and talk about a whole lot in the next 10 minutes when we return on Political Rewind here on GPP.
On the next Fresh Air, the ongoing crisis with contaminated water and lead poisoning in Flint, Michigan. Terry Gross talks with pediatrician and public health advocate Mona Hannah Atisha about the research that led her to sound the alarm back in 2015. Nearly 3 years later, she still doesn't drink tap water there. She's now the director of an initiative to deal with the crisis. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind on GPB. I'm Bradley George, filling in for Bill Nigut. Joining us today, Jim Galloway from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Tamar Haliman from the AJC, and Republican strategist Heath Garrett, Democratic strategist Theron Johnson. So let's talk about what happened, Jim, at the Red Hen restaurant in Lexington, Virginia, over the weekend. Sarah Huckabee Sanders went in there to dine. The owner of that restaurant asked her to leave, saying that the restaurant has certain standards and she felt that she needed to uphold, including honesty, compassion, and cooperation. So she asked Sarah Huckabee Sanders to leave. The president,
which she did without incident.
Right. And now the president weighed in this morning on Twitter. The Red Hen restaurant should focus more on cleaning its filthy canopies, doors and windows. Badly needs a paint job. That's in parentheses. Rather than refusing to serve a fine person like Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I always had a rule. If a restaurant is dirty on the outside, it's dirty on the inside.
Yeah, and this follows the incidents of last week when I think Stephen Miller, a member of the one of the president's advisors, and the Secretary of Homeland Security, they were kind of booed in their D.C. In D.C. eateries. It is where you eat, I guess, has become a very sensitive issue, and I've got to say I'm not pleased to see that. It's everybody eats. Everybody has to eat somewhere. And, you know, dinner is where our diplomacy used to happen. I mean, we used to break bread together. That used to be where it was. But I think, you know, I wrote this morning. This is a sign of the fact that more and more people are living in what we call landslide counties. That we are self-segregating according to political philosophy, not just race, not just by race, but by political philosophy. And you've got 60%, more than 60% of the people who voted in the 2016 presidential contest who live in counties in counties where the winner of the presidential contest in that county won by more than 20 points. Which is up from 50% in 2012 and 30 some odd percent 4 years before that. So it's you know we're self separating ourselves and I find that worrisome.
Theron,
you know I struggle with this one because I've been dealing with people saying you know things to me and restaurant managers and owners not wanting to serve me since I remember growing up in Athens. I mean I remember the Varsity. Which is, you know, a staple of Georgia in mm-hmm. Athens. I remember going in with my mom and protesting against the Varsity because they had a racist white manager who refused to seat black people into. And my mom did a peaceful protest, but my mother never would go out and publicly complain that this restaurant owner didn't want to see her because I think that we understand the time. So let's fast forward 2018. You're the public face for the president of the United States of America. Your job is to carry out his message effectively, right? And let's give her credit. She's done that. I mean, let's remember Sean Spicer? I mean, we forget mm-hmm. this guy was terrible. So for Sarah Huckabee, and I'm not condoning what this owner did, but I think it's this owner's right to choose who he wants to she wants to serve food. So let's not, and I think it's also been mentioned that maybe there was some type of ethics violation. or something on behalf of Sarah Huckabee kind of reporting.
She tweeted it from her government account instead of her personal account.
So let's not leave that out for our listeners. So I would say to Sarah Huckabee, like, okay, you have this image of being this very effective person. I'm not even saying she's a woman. She's a person who goes out and has a hard job of conveying a very difficult message from a president that is very polarizing. So, yes, you got kicked out of a restaurant. You couldn't eat there. That's wrong. But to publicly tweet it from your government account and then for the president to turn around and criticize this owner, therein lies my fundamental problem with it. Because, look, if Heath and I went to a restaurant with a lot of his Republican boys, you know, Chris Riley and all those guys from Isaacson's campaign, Brian Robinson, they hang out, and I'm the only African-American in there, and the owner comes over and probably don't want me to eat there, I mean, I'll feel some type of way about it, but I don't know if I would.
And your friends would walk out with you.
Yeah, my friend. Right. But the same thing, if he goes to Pascal's with me, mm-hmm. and some people have heard him say something on the show, and the owner decides, hey, Heath, you know, we really don't want to serve you for, you know, was that right? I don't think Heath would, he wouldn't like it. I know I wouldn't like it, but I just think that Sarah Huckabee really just dramatized this situation a little too much. It was wrong what happened to her, but you defending the president of the United States, not everyone's going to like you.
I do think there's a double standard here. In the name of compassion and civility, she kicked somebody out of a restaurant for eating food. I mean, it does harken back to when we shouldn't be kicking people out for the color of their skin and or for their political view. If we're going to start doing that, the country's lost, right? We're going to have partisan gerrymandered restaurants. I mean, is that where we're headed? I think that the two wrongs don't make a right. If you don't like this, if you think that the president's not civil enough and engaged in proper political discourse, don't engage back in the same way that you dislike. And at the end of the day, the sadness of where we are in politics is the red hen is winning in this case, and Donald Trump is winning.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't think the red hen is winning. Their website has been taken offline. Their phone number has been jammed to the point that they can't use it.
Oh, but liberal activists are going to flood the Red Hen, and they're going to have more meals served than they ever have. And Donald Trump's winning because he's out there tweeting.
Well,
about
also, I mean, to Jim's point, apparently the chairman of the Republican Party in Virginia has called for a boycott of this place.
Right, but I mean, if we're 50-50. I mean, both sides win in these types of food fights, and it's really part of the problem we've got with modern politics. It pays to be engaged in a fight like this for both sides.
Tamar, you have anything you want to share about this?
Nope.
Have you eaten there?
Yeah. I was surprised. I grew up not too far away from there. I grew up about an hour and a half down the road in Blacksburg, Virginia, and I was surprised to hear of all places where there would be kind of a liberal kind of response.
Yeah, Lexington's a pretty conservative place,
but
right?
Do we know that this owner is liberal? Do we know? No one ever really. This is the thing. Jim is probably looking at me crazy because I'm usually very measured. But like, we don't even know if this woman is a liberal. She could be a conservative, right? She could be a person who voted for Donald Trump. She could be one of these many disaffected Republican women that we know exist in the country. So I just don't think I want to turn this into a partisan issue. I think this woman made a choice that she didn't like what Sarah Huckabee has been saying about this unhinged president, and she told us you couldn't eat there. Period.
All right. To be continued. Theron Johnson, Heath Garrett, Jim Galloway, Tamar Halliman, thank you all very much for joining us today. And thanks to you for listening to Political Rewind. We'll be back with you on Wednesday. Thanks again for listening. Fresh Air is coming up next at 3 o'clock.